come with us now, if you dare, down a rickety staircase into a dank, dark basement. What awaits? The Saturday Night Freak Show.
Welcome back, ladies and germs, to the Saturday Night Freak Show podcast. Every Saturday night, the Freak Show happens, whether you like it or not, right here on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Podbay, TuneIn Radio, and more fine repositories of internet talk. These are the Saturday Night Freak Show Irregulars.
Arian.
Sean.
And I'm Colin. And tonight it was my pick, so we watched Tenebrae. Which is from 1982 and directed by Dario Argento. Okay, so we are going to talk about Tenebrae fans. So spoiler warning. But first, I'd like to talk about a flavor of movie that I've discovered in my travels.
Flavor is a good word.
It's an Italian flavor. It's maybe an acquired taste, but it's like
gelato. Something
like that. Right.
Yeah.
It's called Giallo. Anybody know what Giallo is in Italian?
Yellow.
Do you know why these movies are called Giallo?
Because that was the color of the books in which they were released. Like, there used to be little novels that were yellow covers and whatnot.
That's very true. So these novels started in like... Smart brain, aren't you?
It helps if you read it 5 minutes before the show.
In the liner notes.
Yeah, in the liner notes for this movie.
Well, there was a company called something along the lines of like Moldavi Press, and they made these books in the 20s, 30s, and maybe 40s. And in Italy, they were known as Giallo because of the color of the covers. And they weren't like Italian written books. They were books that were written by, they were thrillers, like Agatha Christie novels would be Giallo. Mm. Writers like Raymond Chandler, Ed McBain, Rex Stout, Ellery Queen, those type of you know, like mystery thrillers, right? They're whodunits.
I've read a few Ellery Queens in my day.
And somewhere in the 60s, maybe like 63, I think the official, we acknowledge like the beginning of the filmic giallo genre began with Mario Bava. He made a movie called The Girl Who Knew Too Much, which starred, ironically, John Saxon, who's also in...
Oh, really?
Tenebrae.
So he had a liking for these movies.
Yeah. So you say to yourself, well, what makes a giallo movie a giallo?
Black gloves.
That's one.
POV of the killer.
That's two.
Weird ass twists.
That's three.
crazy looking sets and lots of boobies.
Red blood. Very red blood.
Yes.
Yes.
This predates the slasher movie. Like the American slasher film kind of gave... Or, you know, became a thing in like the 1980s, right? And you say the slasher window ran from like, you know, whatever, Halloween maybe in 78 until maybe like 1983 or 1984. I mean, it was like the greatest collection of this
stuff. Right, the concentration of it.
Where the same thing happens with Giallo. They start in like, I mean, really like 68 or something like that. They come into their own and they peak in like 71, 72. Dozens of these things are made in Italy.
So what is the peak?
I think it's like 72, 71, 72, and then they kind of...
What movie is considered the peak of this? If we're getting to Tenebrae in 82, and even before that, what do we watch? Deep Red and before this. What is the peak if it's in the early 70s?
Well, Dario Argento made a movie called The Bird with the Crystal Plumage. Mm-hmm. And I think that was 70 or 71. And I think that's widely acknowledged as the moment that, like, the giallo came into its own, kind of. Mm. He used, like, an international star at the time. It was a guy named Tony Masante, I think. Like, so he was an American actor, but brought him over. Because most of the giallos that, you know, we watched were... You know, I mean, they'd still like use a continental cast, but right. You know, mostly, I mean, they made like a star out of Edwige Fennec, who became like the queen of the giallo movie. She was in several of them. Barbara Boucher, George Stevens. But when Bird with the Crystal Plumage was released, it became like a hit, like everywhere. I mean, across, you know, even in America. And so that was, I think, like, you know, maybe all the other ones that came 71, 72 were like trying to cash in on that.
Sure.
But dozens and dozens of these movies, all of them share like the same kind of qualities. They're all shot, you know, in around, well, it seems like, you know, most of them take place in Italy. You have like an old, old world kind of look to them, but you've also got like a modern day nightlife kind of, you know. There's usually a killer whose psychosexual motivation for killing people, you don't find out who it is until the very end. There's a twist, and there's lots of very beautiful women in the movies, usually as the victims.
And about high a fashion. Third of the time, they're all naked.
Yeah, yeah. There's some of them that go like,
you're going to have them in there.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, you watch enough of these things and you're like, man, you know, there's something to them, even though their plots make absolutely no sense.
Sometimes they don't. Yes.
A lot of times. A lot of times. Which I think is why the Argento giallos kind of stand out from the other ones, because, well, I'm not going to say that his necessarily make a whole lot of sense all the time.
He's some coherency.
Yeah, he. It seems like he works a little harder on the writing to get the plot to kind of line up a little more than a lot of the others. I mean, some of the directors kind of focus on the gore, some focus on the sex. He kind of seemed to focus on the plot a little more, which makes them a little easier to understand.
Well, there's less. I mean, like when you watch the other giallos, you know, generally have like a more 60s liberated view of sexuality. I think that's why there's like so much nudity in them. But Argento is like relatively restrained compared to the other ones, you know. But I mean, there's always some kind of like deviancy or aberration, I guess, to his character's psychological, you know, point of view. But I suppose that's true when you have like any kind of, you know, insane homicidal, you know, killer.
I think he likes to play with his characters, because even the side characters, and a lot of them have little twists to their characters. I mean, nobody in his films is really played like a normal character would. They're all just a little bit weird.
You're talking about it, like even the bit players, little characters in the background and all that, still have some kind of like personality quirk that makes them usually humorous, it seems like, right?
Right.
But that makes it stand out. You know, they're unusual.
That just reminds me of that scene in Tenebrae. I think there's a quick shot of two people at the bar. He's like, when are you going to photograph me? Never. It's fuck off.
Yeah, you said like there's a whole
story. You get the whole story of those people right there. Just like, oh, all right, that's nice. It's a nice little sprinkling of seasoning in this movie. I thought that was enjoyable.
Yeah. The other thing that the giallo movies are known for is their crazy titles. Mm. Some of them, you know, go way out of their way to, you know, just like the Black Belly of the Tarantula, or, you know, like I said, the aforementioned.
And there are no tarantulas in that movie.
I don't remember. I think it's metaphorical. It's the killer has a web, you know, that catches people, and you know, All the Colors of the Dark, I think, is like one of my favorite titles, just because it sounds awesome.
Was there an actual bird with crystal plumage in The Bird with Crystal Plumage?
Which always reminds me of the title, The Maltese Falcon.
Yeah, yeah, right? It's like an art object on somebody's desk, like maybe in the killer's lair or something like that. There is a bird with the... Oh, no, it's the sound that eventually triggers it helps them catch the killer. There's a bird outside of, like, the house, and they hear the recording or something like that. Uh-huh. My memory on it's not all that.
all that bird repeat it back, and they're just like, oh.
Yeah, yeah, the blood-stained shadow. You know, I mean, so they had these really Baroque titles where, you know, you had some kind of combination of a number, an animal, a color. And then some kind of like, I don't know what you'd say would be the fourth like abstract thing. I know the one title, which is a Dario Argento movie, which covers like all the quadrants, is Four Flies, on gray velvet. Mm. So you've kind of got, you know, everything in there. It's magical, magical title. So
there should be like an, was there, wait, no, there was, wasn't there like a giallo name generator somewhere on the internet?
Yeah.
You just come up with some random shit. Like
I used that.
Blue Tears of the Night or something like that.
Uh-huh. All right. So stay tuned later for before we do the, before we summon Igor for the mailbag. I went on the random giallo generator and I generated some titles. So I'm going to mix in, we're going to have a little quiz where we're going to have some real giallo titles and some fake giallo titles. And we're going to see if Arian and Sean can tell which ones are which. But this, so Dario Argento, did you know that he started off, you know who Bernardo Bertolucci is?
I've heard the name.
Last Tango in Paris?
Yes.
And The Last Emperor and all that. So
the Dreamers? Did you do Dreamers?
He did the Dreamers.
He did the Dreamers, yep.
So he and Argento. So Argento was, his father was a producer in the Italian movie industry. And Dario got his start as a film critic and then he worked up and then became a screenwriter. And with Bernardo Bertolucci, they wrote Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in the West. So that was the thing that actually started Dario Argento. Then he got his directing opportunity with The Bird with the Crystal Plumage. It became a huge deal. And so they were like, you know, it fired off the whole the giallo trend. And it was like, okay, we need you to make more of these. So he made in quick order Bird with the Crystal Plumage, The Cat of Nine Tails, Four Flies on Grey Velvet. These are now regarded as his animal trilogy. He made a comedy called 5 Days in Milan. Nobody went to see. So then he came back and did Deep Red or Profondo Rosso, which many people regard as the best giallo ever made.
Damn, really?
I would regard it as his maybe best. Definitely up there.
Yeah. I mean, there's like usually when you talk Argento, it's either Deep Red or Suspiria jockeying for, you know, the best career.
I would agree
best.
With that. Mm.
But, you know, he followed Deep Red. Well, I guess like it's like what does Deep Red do that like.
Why does it stand out?
Yeah. Because it catalogs a certain, I mean, it like, what do you call that? When you take like, you know, something, you're setting it in stone, basically. It's right. Like after that, this is what a giallo is.
It's setting a standard for.
Yeah. It contextualizes it. Now. Yeah. Catalogs it. No, something. Looking for a word.
Well,
but
it
I can't
had
remember
a, you know, I mean, there's always
the
like the clues that go through and half of them either don't make sense or you don't get them till towards the end when they're getting ready to show you who the killer is. And in Deep Red, like the clue, you see at the very beginning and they don't put any emphasis on it whatsoever. But when it comes together at the end, it's brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is also, Deep Red is one of those movies where I think, and I mentioned this to Sean earlier, it's like, I think it's one of those movies that is in danger of being ruined by the video era, because this is a movie shot in a time when you couldn't go rent the thing afterwards. There was no rewind button. So he uses that in a way where you see the clue, you actually see the murderer early on in the movie. In a flash. So you're not sure that what you actually saw.
Yes.
But, it, you know, in today's world, I think you'd go, wait, I saw something, hit pause, rewind, and then you'd be staring at the face of the murderer.
Where right.
I think, you know, it works if you just play it like, you know, there is no stopping this thing. You keep going. It puts you in the headspace of the protagonist. And I think this is one of the things that Argento does that kind of defines his style, is he usually has a character who somehow has the clue to solving the entire thing and is like playing memory games with himself. It's like, I saw something, but I don't know what it is.
But that can't be right.
The audience has seen from the lead character's point of view, you know, the killing or something. You also witness the exact same thing. So it's almost kind of it's like interactive in that way where you have to like try and figure out like, well, I saw the exact same thing he did.
Right. Yeah. It's just watching Deep Red. Like that was, that's the thing. You know, you get that same image they do and you're just like, I saw something. You kind of file it away as you're watching the movie. Like, well, I think it's this, but let's see where they're going. Like, definitely puts you in there with them.
Yeah. You have to do some mental gymnastics.
Yeah, you do. Because like, you're going back later on going, kind of thinking the same thing. The character's like, I saw something in the mirror. Yeah. Like, that's got to play somehow.
It was because it wasn't him. When you were, because you're like, oh, wait a second. He couldn't have been there. He couldn't be the killer because he was there at the, and like a minute later, the guy in
right.
the movie.
You're playing
like,
the same game.
And you're like, couldn't, it's impossible.
He was there and she was down there and that person was down there at the same time.
Mm. Well, and it's also kind of cool because it actually sets up a reason for this character to want to continue looking into this thing, which is something that drives me crazy with all the giallo movies, is the protagonist is never a cop or detective or anybody who has any reason to be investigating mm-hmm. these
or
murders.
To be that invested in finding this stuff
yeah,
out.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And
it's like, I could be a detective today.
Yeah, it's uh-huh. like none of them ever makes sense, but, you know, at least for Deep Red, that character and the way that it played out, it actually made sense because you are put into his eyes. You could see where it would drive you crazy that I saw something, something's going on. You could actually see why he was investigating it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's another hallmark of the genre also is the amateur detective, right? Mm. But I mean, I think that even goes back to Agatha Christie, Rex Stout, yeah. you know, all, you know, it's like those are the, that is like a trademark of that type of story where in giallo, usually it seems like the lead character is an artist or works yeah. somehow in the art world, photographer, pianist,
writer,
painter, writer.
Right. You know. And a lot of the times it seems like they're traveling, you know, they're not permanently stationed where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
They just happen to be there at the right time.
Yeah, they're always visiting like a foreign country or, you yeah. know, it's like, Suspiria is kind of, you know, is it a giallo? You know, kind of. But, you know, you have an American in Germany or in Deep Red, you have an American in Rome, Tenebrae, an American in Rome. You have an Algerian woman, Edwige Fennec is Algerian. So she's in Italy, I think, you know, for all the colors of the dark. I mean, they're all like, you know, passing through. Mm. And while they're there, they become, you know, witness to something or the target of a killer or Hitchcock's favorite character, the man falsely accused. They yes. end up, you know, it's like, it's you and the cops are following you, you know. Mm. You're the guy who did it when you're like, I didn't actually do it. I was just, you know, I saw it happen. But there's a lot of talk that, you know, because they are suspense thrillers, that they borrow a lot of the language, the film language of Alfred Hitchcock, or maybe Argento more than the others, because he was known for a while as the Italian Hitchcock.
Makes sense.
I mean, well, I see in some ways, you know, it's like, did he borrow it from Hitchcock or did he borrow it from Sergio Leone? You know, all the use of close-ups and stuff like that are shots used in Sergio Leone Westerns, right? The Fistful of Dollars and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And
yeah.
But the thing that Argento seems to use that Hitchcock also used is the roving camera, where the camera is almost seems to be a character unto itself, where you'll have two characters framed up. They'll have a conversation, they'll walk away, and then the camera will take off independently and go over and show you, the audience, something that the characters are unaware of.
Yeah.
Or it'll leave the characters while they're talking about something. It's like the camera decides this isn't important and wanders over and goes and looks at something else or sees the killer coming in or, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, and I believe it was Tenebrae or maybe it was Deep Red. There was at one point, yeah, it was Deep Red. There was at one point where it was Tenebrae. The camera moves from looking at one woman to outside the house, goes completely around the outside of the house, the roof, the windows,
shot.
The walls. And that's like, what, 3 minutes of nothing but the
shot.
Camera moving around the outside of the house. There's nothing to see.
Super technical.
There's nothing going on. No reason for that shot other than they must have thought it was cool or something.
Yeah, it calls attention to itself. It's like, look how showy I am.
Yeah.
I mean,
it kind of does because there's no like, there's no ending to it. It's just like, oh, you did it for that. It's just like, oh, we kind of like a cut. going mm-hmm. from where they show, where they start off to where they end, like could have, like, yeah, and they're not telling us anything new or giving us any information with that shot.
Yeah,
it's just kind of a glorified, like, we're going to go all over the place.
Yeah, and it's not like putting you in the eye of a killer or anything like
that.
Yeah,
because he's not scaling the building and coming down.
Yeah, it's just there for the sake of, I guess, showing off the camera. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Well, once you actually see the thing put together with the camera move associated with the music, because Argento worked with the rock band Goblin for a while, and they broke up or something. So Claudio Simonetti, who was a part of Goblin, did the music for Tenebrae. So it's we say it's basically Goblin music.
Sure.
But it's loud on the soundtrack. And so you're listening to like this disco track or something on the soundtrack as this camera's prowling over the top of the house and looking in the windows. And I guess it creates suspense because you're like, you know,
like,
it's just weird, right? You start at a window with a woman in the window, and then you pan up and crawl over the house and look in some windows, spying on the girl upstairs, and eventually coming down to rest on the killer gaining access to the, bottom window on the other side.
Oh, yeah, it does end up with that. Just, yeah, cutting into the blinds and everything and going in.
Yeah.
I suppose so. It does kind of end up with something substantial. All right, take that back.
Well, I looked at it because I was curious about that shot, because it's one of those, you know, because it calls attention to itself, you're like, how in the hell did they do that? I mean, do they have a crane
arm? Oh, they
must have
had a crane, like, at a corner of the house.
It was on, the crane is actually on a platform, so you're already halfway up the house.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can drop down and swing up.
Oh, yeah, so, yeah, because it goes, like, it's and it has to be at the corner, because it can go up one side, hit the roof that it goes over, and then come down on the other side and peek into the side of the house. It had to be at the corner.
Well, and when it gets to the roof, it like takes a while looking at the roof, but then it does this extreme close up of the tiles on the roof. And I always kind of wonder if they use that to mess with the set a little bit and turn things around.
I think you can see the making of that shot is in a documentary. It's on YouTube. Ooh. It's called Dario Argento's World of Horror. There's two really good documentaries on him. There's World of Horror and an Eye for Horror, which, you know, detail the making of a couple of his movies and interviews and all this stuff. But that one actually has like behind the scenes footage of making moments from Suspiria and Tenebrae.
Nice.
So you can actually see the crane rig and all that stuff that they use. But, I mean, I guess we're talking about that because it's like the style, Argento's style so defined the giallo genre that, you know, it's like, I mean, he's the guy who, I mean, he's made his entire career out of making like almost one type of movie, you know, and trying to, and I mean, he writes a lot of them too, but, you know, trying to come up with the twist that you're like, holy crap, you know, like that's, you know, unusual and weird. And, you know, he hasn't done it before. And, you know, yeah. So Tenebrae is a movie about a writer. His name is Peter Neal. He's an American author, and he moves to, or he's visiting Rome to promote his latest book.
On his press tour.
Now, I said this earlier, but now you're going to have to see if this jibes or not. But I think Tenebrae is to the giallo genre what Scream, or maybe In the Mouth of Madness, which are you know, two recent shows that we did. You can look them up on iTunes and Stitcher. It is like it's the postmodern dissection of the giallo movie. Mm. True or false?
True. I was thinking to myself that Scream kind of stole a bit of the plot of Tenebrae.
Because it's
because when Scream came out, you know, everybody was like wigging out at the end because they had two killers instead of just the one. And everybody thought that was brilliant and clever, but Tenebrae had done that, you know, in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So Scream wasn't being original in doing it. They were stealing it from another movie.
It's almost like it looks at it. It gives you like the classic giallo for like the first part of the movie. And then kind of goes off into a different version of it. Because the first part, I mean, there's a different, again, spoiler alerts, there's like an original killer, the TV host who killed the women, and then it kind of goes off from that. Well, like, well, he's dead, and people are still getting murdered. Yeah. So it kind of feels
doesn't
like
tell
that.
You that, though. You no. don't know that until the end.
Right.
Of the movie.
It's like it's giving you that, but also kind of playing with the expectations of mm-hmm. what is considered classic giallo. So it definitely could be.
Well, I think the fact that it's like it's, and maybe like it also shares something with Wes Craven's New Nightmare, where you have a filmmaker making a movie about a guy who writes horror stories or thriller stories, right? And finds himself in the plot of a horror novel. Mm-hmm. So it's making comments on, I think, like, you know, are horror movie or horror authors, horror, you know, storytellers
responsible
for the actions of
their
yeah. audience? Because the movie is about there's a copycat killer, or, you know, he gets in Rome. This guy goes to Rome and finds out that there are murders happening where the killer is copying murders that have happened in his book,
right.
Tenebrae.
And quoting them and sending them those in little letters under his door.
Yeah. So he's basically saying to the author, the killer's saying to the author, it's like, look, I'm doing this almost to honor you.
Yes.
You wrote and showed me how to do it. And so now I'm doing it. The killer's motivation is the way he interprets the book.
Right. He's taking his interpretation and going by that.
Which is what?
Which is that I think eliminating, what does he call them, perverts? Like the perversion. Like he's finding those people and eliminating them, it kind of seems.
Yeah. Well, he kills that first girl is a thief.
The shoplifter.
We're not entirely sure.
Yeah, she's got like 12 prior shoplifting or...
Yeah.
And she gets caught stealing the Tenebrae book.
Yeah. She gets off in one of the ways that can only be Italian.
Maybe I give you my number and, you know, for later.
Okay.
It's like, okay.
So she gets busted, caught shoplifting, red-handed. Dude takes her back into his office. She propositions him, gives him her home address, and he's like, okay. And he gives her the book.
It's like, yeah, he shoves the book back in the purse. Like, here you go. On your way. Take the book.
That's amazing.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
You can get away with that. I can get away with that.
Yeah. And then the second murders are a pair of lesbian lovers, one of whom may be a prostitute.
Maybe.
We're not entirely sure.
Yeah. I don't think.
The third murder is a... she's a girl that Peter Neal happens to know personally. Well, I guess he knew personally one of the lesbians. She was a critic.
Yeah, she's a critic who's always, like, before that, always been nice about his work, and suddenly in his press tour kind of attacks him on his kind of his themes or his motivations for writing the book, Tenebrae.
Well, I think that was what put her on the murderer's radar.
Because he was there at the time.
Originally, yeah, when the author first comes to town, you know, there's a, you know, welcome party, and the killer happens to be at that party, and, you know, he's just kind of not talking, standing in the corner watching what's going on, and this woman comes in as a writer, and she's known the author for a while, and they've had a great relationship, but she, like, immediately pounces on him for the way he treats the women in his latest novel.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I have to assume that is criticism. Like, what she says is probably, like, verbatim criticism that
Argento has gotten.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's got to be.
Yeah.
No, that would make sense because it's true.
Well, he did say I don't know. There's a quote that I remember reading in an issue of Cinefantastic came out. It's online now. I think I still have the issue. It was about this movie. But he said something to the effect of that he prefers to look at beautiful women, and he would prefer if he was going to kill someone in his movies, he'd prefer that it would be a beautiful woman rather than an ugly one. And so that quote has basically been taken and used, like, in years since as, like, proof of Dario Argento's misogyny.
Well, let's be honest. If, you know, even myself speaking as a female, if I'm watching a horror movie, chances are it's going to be a woman getting killed or a man. But if it's a woman, it's almost always a pretty woman. And I think a big reason for that, aside from the obvious sexual part, is because there's more emotion involved. You know, people don't like to see something beautiful get destroyed.
I think that's what it is. I'm glad to hear you say that. Somebody, I seriously think that that's...
It is. And somebody
you
said
you have
today,
more empathy for a female character in Jeopardy somehow, right?
Yeah. Than, and even, like, even good looking. Because somebody said today, like, I was reading this, it's ironic this comes up, but somebody said today, like, I mean, that's why, like, Hollywood movies cast actors and actresses who are good looking people. Like, because, I mean, the regular public kind of pays to see that, like, yeah, in the situations they're in.
Like, at some level. At some level, like, that is all fantasy. You know, it's like, even I mean, it's the most realistic scenario, but everybody looks like, you know,
everyone's perfectly pretty and everything. But yeah. I mean, like, that's, I mean, we kind of, like, that's something we go to see.
Mm-hmm.
That's funny.
Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, is he misogynistic? There's so much that he does. It seems like even like his treatment of homosexuals in the two movies that we watched is, I think, for the time, like, you know, I mean, because in Deep Red, David Hemming's friend ends up being gay, and it's just kind of like, okay, you're gay, you know. And this is 1975,
right?
You know, which I have to imagine was kind of
probably a big shock.
Good
yeah,
thing. Even yeah, because even the character, in Deep Red, the one his friend who ends up being gay,
Carlo.
Yeah, he's in, like, doesn't he? I mean, he uses the F word. It's like, you just thought I was some.
Yeah, I'm.
Like, yeah, at some point, didn't he?
Like
even
I,
he's.
Yeah, he was
saying,
drunk,
like,
on
this
the
is
bed.
What you thought
he's
of me.
Like, not only am I a drunk, I'm a faggot to
yeah.
boot or something
yeah.
to
yeah,
that
yeah,
effect.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, that's, you know, transgressive, I think, in yeah. its politics, sexual politics for 1975, because, you know, well
that
wait.
They had a transvestite open the door.
And this is going to spoil Deep Red, but it does turn out that Carlo is, you know, well, he's never actually the killer, but at the end, he's the guy who's, you know, like, I'm going to kill you because
he's
you
the
saw
one
my
that's
secret.
Presented as the killer.
Yeah, so maybe that's not such a great, you know.
But it's also kind of interesting because you're hearing, I think it was two detectives discussing the profile of the killer, and they were saying that it's a psychosexual maniac mm-hmm. is the killer.
Yeah.
And when you're presented with Carlo as the killer, that fits him, but then it turns out that it's not him at all.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
something completely well, different.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's tricky, but I don't know. Maybe it's not as progressive as I thought it was.
Well, for the time that movie was made, you
yeah.
know.
It's still probably just to even deal with it. I don't know. I mean, like, I don't know if later on in his career when he was kind of promoting his daughter, Asia, to the starring roles.
That's a more famous daughter?
Yeah, she becomes, well, because the other one's like Fiore, and she was yeah. in, you know, like Demons or whatever. But Asia becomes a more, like a stronger female protagonist, right? Because yeah. prior to that, it was Dario's girlfriend, Daria Nicolodi, who was in Deep Red. She's in Tenebrae. She's in Phenomena. She's in Inferno. She's in like one scene in Suspiria, so it doesn't count. But you can kind of see, I've read it once, that like you can see the deterioration of their relationship based on
oh, really?
How he killed, like, and she lives through Deep Red, but he starts killing her in more and more, you know, tough ways throughout the movies.
No.
And then eventually replaces her with the daughter.
It's like you're gone.
Who becomes like his avatar in the later,
sure.
in the later films. But yeah, so the killings in Tenebrae, we left off with the service girl, right?
Yes.
She was the hotel's
she gets attacked by the, like you said, the most well trained dog in cinema history.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. This Doberman Pinscher that can scale walls and
yeah,
fences.
It's a talented
and
dog.
But she is a deviation from the murder pattern because she was a victim of opportunity. or yeah, circumstance, because she stumbles upon the killer's hidden lair by accident. Mm. And so he has to make a deviation from his plan to kill her. And then that's what seems to bring the focus, you know, onto the killer.
Yes.
Because, you know, he's been
three blocks away from
right in his neighborhood.
Yeah, right in his neighborhood, she's killed. And so they're like, and that's where you were talking about earlier, like kind of the meta sense of the author in his own story. Like, even in, at that point, I think he, like him, Anne is
his secretary.
Yeah, yeah. Anne is secretary. And what's the his the servant boy?
Gianni?
Gianni. Yeah, Gianni. Like, they all sit down and, like, try and figure out at this point. They become the detectives and see, like, how does this work?
Yeah.
That's the meta sensibility coming in. And they go, like, they're like, it's killed three blocks from his house. And so they, like, go off and investigate.
Mm-hmm. I like the way the police detective is also, you know, involved in this, you know, little circle. They're trying to, you know, crack this case. But he says, you know, I've read all your books, and I can never figure out who did it. And I'm a detective.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so it is at this point that in the film where Peter Neal and Gianni, or Gianni, it's like the Italian of Gianni, right?
Gianni.
Well, they don't do hard J's.
Right. So they go to investigate who Peter Neal believes is the killer, which is a fan of his and a talk show host named Cristiano Lamberto or something like this. And so it's really carefully staged in a way that obscures what is actually happening at this point in the movie, because Cristiano has been the murderer, has been the devoted fan, says when he is confronted by a figure that we don't see, you know, I did it. I killed them all. But it's in the rain and you can't hear it all that well. And then he gets hit in the head with an axe. And so you're like, well, this can't be the killer. This is another victim. They thought he was potentially a suspect, but he's just a victim. And then when Gianni, you know, because from Gianni's point of view, he doesn't see who actually killed the guy. Mm-hmm. And when he comes running back to where Peter Neal is, Peter's been hit on the top of the head. He's bleeding. And he says, the killer cold cocked me and, you know, ran off. And there's an interesting scene that if you know what's going on, where they get into Gianni's VW bug or whatever.
It's very small.
And Peter Neal is like, did you see him? Did you see the killer? And, you know, he's fishing at that point. If you read it right, it's like he's fishing to find out if Gianni saw him So the psychology of Peter Neal is what? It's tied back to somehow in his past in Rhode Island when he was in school.
Yes.
Because he keeps having these flashbacks. We don't know whose flashbacks they are. We assume
they're the killers. Yeah.
You go into the movie assuming there's one killer. So it's like, wait, who is doing what? But why don't you explain what we're seeing there?
I mean, the first flashback is it's a woman and she's teasing like a group of young boys. They're walking down the like beachside and everything. And, you know, she's slipping off her dress, showing off. And it's very weird because she like gets down on her knees and they all just like crotch first right into her. And then the killer.
You never see their faces.
No, you never see their faces.
Like, men's legs. That's right. All you ever see. Mm-hmm.
And then who we assume like the killer comes up, and for some reason he gets very angry at this behavior and everything, and he slaps her. And then he runs off. And the other boys chase him down and tackle him and get him like splayed on the ground and hold him down. And she comes along, this woman, and sticks her red heel like in his mouth. And just, you know, and she's punishing him for obviously hitting her. But
are we supposed to read that as something more invasive? Is that oral rape?
I mean, I'm sure there was that motivation behind it. Just based on the staging of the men and her, it kind of feels like that's what it is.
So it's like something, this moment of humiliation is what it breaks the mind of the, well,
doesn't help.
Who we know is now later is Peter Neal.
Right.
Okay, so is that how it's supposed to be read?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
I can see a few different ways of reading that, and I never understood which way it was supposed to be read, or if this was just his mind, you know, forcing out his hatred against women. that they use their sexuality to humiliate men. I never understood it. I thought those flashbacks didn't make any sense. I didn't think
You could look at it that way. Like, she uses her sexuality to draw those boys in and then ends up humiliating the one. I mean, that's, I mean.
As for some reason,
she's like controlling the boys.
But he, yeah, except for him.
Yeah.
He's the one that, like, her lure isn't working on her. He sees through it or something.
Right. Doesn't like it. Doesn't approve.
And so then they attack him. Would it disturb you to learn that the actress was a transgender actress? That's a man.
It wouldn't even surprise me. She looked kind of weird, especially her nose.
You look at the wrists, very thick wrists.
I can't tell.
But
I might couldn't tell.
Then, you know, apparently, so the character, Peter Neal, had gone back and murdered her later. And
yeah,
so this
is second flashback.
That's the moment that crystallizes, I guess, that he's a, you know, psychotic, right? And so then throughout the entire movie, he's been popping pills to, I guess, well, I mean, what, it's the headaches, right? He's trying to control the headaches that he gets because we see some shadowed figure. Like doing the
I almost forgot that part. I'm like popping pills. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? It's like, oh yeah, we get the silhouette of the craziness and the water and the pills. That's right.
Yeah,
I always attributed that to the critic killer.
Right, but well, you're supposed to. Right, but that's actually I think that's actually Peter Neal. Like, once the movie's over, you realize you know that's whole time, and then.
Red shoes as well.
That's once the
was up with the red shoes?
Well, the woman. I mean, he sends the. I think the connection is. I think the woman who shoved her heel in his mouth. She was wearing the red shoes, mm-hmm. and I think the way he felt about her. That's why he sends Jane the red shoes.
This is his fiance.
This is his former fiance.
Well, the cop said it was his fiance, but they seem to be on the outs. And he realizes that Jane, his fiance, is having an affair with his agent, John Saxon.
So the humiliation he kind of felt from the woman in the flashback wearing the red shoes, I think he also feels the same thing towards Jane. Mm-hmm. That's why he sends her the red shoes.
Because she's cheating on him. Because
she's cheating on him. So the humiliation, like, he's transferring that to her.
Oh, you know what? Now you could actually see... That first, the line of dialogue that he has with her when he's on the phone at the airport, he says, Jane, the reason I haven't talked to you in 6 weeks is, and then that gets cut off.
Yeah.
And then he has to do the, I'm just going to hang up.
I'm
going to hang up on you. But what if he finished that line and it was because I found out about you and John Saxon? In which case, he would know the whole time that he's going over there, he's been humiliated. Right. So he's like, I don't want to talk to her, have anything to do with her anymore. And the, fact that there is a killer out there, you know, that he finds out about before the cops do. He realizes who the killer is. He kills the killer and then says, now I have an opportunity to kill Jane and her lover. And they'll blame it on
the previous one,
the killer, because they don't know he's dead.
See, I would have left the killer alive until after I had killed Jane and.
Well, yeah, but it's like, was he thinking that far ahead? I have to assume, like, because the cop is like buddy-buddy with him at this point. The cop is telling him, like, you need to get out of town. And he's like, well, I want to get out of town because I just killed a couple people. And you're telling me to get out. I was like, okay, I'm going to go to Paris or something. I'm going to be safe because the killer, this is the other thing that, you know, the killer, the first killer targets Peter Neal by... calling him and sending him the messages. Yes. So, you know, he's actually taunting him on the phone. This is actually what inspired the movie. Argento was in L.A. doing a press tour for whatever it must have been in Suspiria or Inferno and started getting calls from a fan that got, you know, more and more disturbing. He said he moved to like somewhere down in like Venice Beach or something like that. And then a week later, the calls started up again. And so he was disturbed with this. He took off and went back to Rome. And this kind of fed into the idea of this movie. But yeah, once, you know, so Peter Neal, now we have established, or the movie hasn't, but we're establishing that he is a killer and has been since he was younger. Now having this opportunity, kills these people and is like going to take off and go to Paris. there's a scene, I think, where he's dropped off at the airport and we see a shot of a plane flying away.
Right.
So we're like, okay, well, you never see him on the plane.
No. You're always assuming like, well, there's the plane.
Yeah.
He's on that one.
But at that point in the movie, you're still left going, well, who's the killer? Because we think, you know, the first time I think you go through this movie, you're like, okay, there's these people who are dying all over the place. You can't really figure out a motive. You know, what is going on? Now Peter Neal has left. Like, who's actually doing the killings?
Right.
And the only people that it seems like they direct your attention toward are Jane, the fiance, who we know is in town because John Saxon gets killed.
Yes, he does.
We don't see who kills him. Somebody stabs him in the gut.
Yeah, he was waiting for Jane to show up.
But we don't know that.
Well, I think we do.
We do.
I think we do know that.
Because they were going to arrange to meet for lunch.
Right. He's waiting for her to show up. After he gets killed, like, she does show up because you see the red heels and the dress, and she shows up to see him dead and then moves on. Mm-hmm. Like, to kind of give you that, like, little push, like, oh, maybe she did it.
Right. Because we see the red shoes, we figure this is the person who actually killed
him. But if you look at the flashbacks, like, it's obviously, I mean, if you're going to take anything out of the flashbacks, it's like, well, this is probably our killer. I mean, and it's got to be a man because, obviously, you know, it's the boy who got embarrassed with a heel in the mouth, and it's obviously a man who killed the woman in the second flashback. Mm-hmm. So you got to figure it's a man at that point if you're really looking at it. But they do kind of put it on Jane, especially with the red heels.
Yeah.
But that gets it kind of explained later.
And she invites the secretary, you know, Daria Nicolodi, Anne, over to the house.
Yes.
Where, you know, she's sitting there waiting with a gun.
She is.
And it's like, you know, okay, we've established that Jane is unstable because we know this because she sees a psychiatrist or a therapist or something like that, right? And she's flown all the way to Rome for whatever the hell, I guess, the rendezvous with the agent. She waits with a gun, which I guess I read this time. I suppose it's because, you know, she saw John Saxon dead.
Right.
She figures somebody is also coming after her.
See, but it still doesn't make any sense, though, because she calls and asks specifically for Anne to come over and talk to her. So she knows that Anne is on her way. So the way it's presented with her holding in the gun, you're left wondering, what, is she going to try to kill Anne?
Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, you get that because with the, like, kind of the suspicion that's been thrown on her from John Saxon being dead and to see her sitting there with a gun, like, you're still thinking, like, yeah. I mean, they're kind of making it obvious for us. Because
she may have killed John Saxon.
Right.
She had the red shoes and they were there. And
right. So with the gun, you're just like, oh, she's going to kill Anne.
Yeah.
But she's really just like paranoid.
Yeah. Because
she saw John Saxon. She's like, somebody else, like somebody's killing people. I could be next. I need to protect myself.
Yeah.
And sorry, go ahead.
Part of the problem is that the acting isn't all that great. So you can't tell from her acting skills, you know, if she's like gearing up to kill somebody or if she's just scared and needs
help. I think that's the point they're driving home. Like, they don't want you to know what she's doing.
They want you to be guessing.
Yeah.
It's like, is she or is she, what's
going on? Like, is it this obvious she's going to try and kill her? Is she, I mean, you look back at it now, you're like, oh, she's paranoid because of the stuff that happened before.
And then this sets up one of, I think, the greatest murder scenes in movie history.
That's,
I mean,
really just, good.
It's, you know, she's sitting in front of this plate glass window, and the axe comes down on her arm, and then she sprays a geyser of blood on this
red blood on a white wall.
White wall. Yeah. I mean, it's just I mean, it's one of those moments where you're like, it's hideous, but this is like visually a beautiful shot, you know, red blood on a
bloody
white wall
arts.
Just kind of going across the thing. I mean, it's really something to look at. And you're like, who came up with, I mean, I guess that's why, you know, it's the flair and the style.
Inventive murder scenes.
Yeah.
I'd be curious to know how many takes that took to get that right.
I'm guessing one.
I'm going to say
because
one.
Because in the subsequent shots in the movie, you can still see that wall with
and it's
that
the
pattern
same spray.
On it.
Yeah.
I'm like, they had one shot at that and did it probably on the first.
Right. It's like, whatever we get, that's what we got to go with.
Yeah.
They did well.
Yeah.
It's a good shot.
But then we find out shortly thereafter, you know, a woman walks in the door who looks like Anne, and Peter, the killer, strikes her on the back of the head and kills her. And it's that moment he's like, oh, my God, I've killed Anne. And we find out that it's Peter Neal is the killer. So, I mean, that's like the big shock moment in the movie that our protagonist, who we've been with this entire time, actually is, you know, the killer. And then he's, you know, relieved, I guess, to find out that he actually killed the
female inspector.
Yeah. Where everybody looks the same in this movie. I was saying that earlier, but, you know, it's like, I don't know if it's a theme or something, but it's like that you have doubles.
You have Peter, it can't be an accident to be that close in what they look like and what they're wearing.
Yeah. Well, at the end, when he freaks out about that, that's when I kind of realize, like, oh, well, boy, they've been setting that up all along.
Mm-hmm. Right.
When you had mentioned that the suits were closed, and when he got a phone call across the street, and he was standing by the window with his assistant Anne across from him, the person across the street looking in said, you know, I see you standing there with a woman. And so the inspector, female inspector, takes Anne's place, and she can't tell the difference. Mm-hmm. So it's like they kind of allude to that throughout the movie, just, I think, so that the ending will pay off.
It's possible. That, you know, I mean, because the other thing is that you have the duality of, you know, you've got two killers who are mirrors kind of themselves. You have the guy who writes the, you know, are they mirrors? I guess. One thinks about killing people, and the other one actually does what the first one thinks. Mm. So maybe that's a one person. They form one part of a symbiotic.
Different sides of.
And so then the cop is like the double of Peter Neal because he's the actual inspector.
Right. He's like, and he even mentions that at some point in the movie. It's just like, I still have to turn over dead bodies at some point. It's like, we're both investigating, but I have to do this. See, he does mention that too.
Yeah. And at the end, Peter Neal says that this whole thing, like he basically, he mentions a couple times that, you know, he, when we are with him, when he's still the protagonist, he says he's trying to solve the movie, the case, by working out the plot of a book.
Yes.
And then later, when he's actually killed people, he says, I laid it out just like the plot of a book, you know. It's like, so he is living a story. He made a story come to life. You know, for all intents and purposes, but he was caught because of, you know, he thought he killed Anne, who he actually does have some real feeling for, I think.
Apparently, yes. I mean, they've been together for, what, 6 years, they say? Yeah. 6 years. We never spent a night together.
Yeah.
But, so, again, I mean, their closeness gets mentioned kind of throughout.
A little bit.
You know, it's like he asked her to stay for a nightcap, and you can kind of see that he's kind of feeling the waters, but she's keeping it professional. And, you know, at one point she's talking to herself, kind of making fun of him a little bit, you know.
Mm. Well, the only person that he kills, well, I get the he kills the detective, I guess, because he has to at the end. And he seems like he's about to kill Anne at the end because he has to.
And he's killed John Saxon.
Well, yeah, but he killed John Saxon, and like those were his targets.
Yes.
John Saxon and Jane were his targets. He kills Gianni, but as you're watching this the second time around, I'm like, Gianni just keeps like, you know, after the first time, he's
go
like,
home,
I didn't see anything. He's like, you're a good kid, go home. And then the second time, it's like, I know there's something that I missed at that house.
Right.
And it's like, he looks at him kind of weird. And the third time, he's like, okay, you're leaving. I'm going to go back to that house because I know there's something that I saw or heard there that is going to crack this case. And then at that point, it's like,
that's,
you gotta take care of
that's the stupid move in the movie. Like,
kind of
first of all, the killer's still like out there. Like, why would you go back to that place by yourself?
Yeah.
And he pays for it. Choked in the car.
I found that kind of ironic that, you know, in Tenebrae, Johnny saw something that he thought would crack the case. Which is kind of a parallel to Deep Red. Deep Red, where same thing happened. The protagonist saw something that he thought would, you know, kind of solve this whole thing. And yet their roles kind of get switched. The one, you know, becomes the hero for it and solves it.
Yeah.
And the other one gets killed.
Yeah. It's a smart inversion, I guess. I mean, that's how, you know, as an artist, I guess, you try to, you know, you're doing basically the same, you're working in the same genre. So there's rules and limits, but somehow he figures out a way to like twist them just right. a
Move
little
them a
bit.
Little bit.
So it's like, oh, this is a new thing. You can't say that Tenebrae is a remake of Deep Red or Bird with the Crystal Plumage or Four Flies in Grey Velvet. And I haven't seen Cat and Nine Tails, so I don't know.
But even when we think they're dead, they're not dead.
Yeah, and it has a shot where, you know, the killer is revealed to be standing directly behind a person who's standing in the foreground.
I mean,
who
first
ducks
of all,
out a shot,
right?
And first, they're there,
like Peter, like you know, he's found out, like he's the killer, and you know, they're like the police officer's going to arrest him, and like out of nowhere, he's like he's got the blade. And he turns around, he's like, ah, and he's freaking out, cutting his own throat, blood spurting everywhere. And he falls to the ground dead, and everyone's like, all right, it's over. Like, the cop immediately goes to the phone, he's like, no, it's done. Let's go to the car.
Yeah.
Where they have a bit
don't
of
don't check for a pulser.
Yeah, no. He's dead. He cut his own throat. Yeah. Why would you check?
He's got a special effects a knife.
Apparently, they go to the car, have a conversation that the exposition scene, which kind of explains, like, well, why would he do this? Because he's explaining to a hysterical woman, Anne. And then he's like, I should go back inside. Why does he go back inside?
That makes I
need to be there for the police. Like, it feels like, but he's the like the
plot point.
He's still a cop. Like, he's the like he's not going to leave. He's the cop on scene. Like, he's going to go there and wait because he's called in backup. He's like, this happened. So he's going to go back in there and wait for people to show up. You know, because you know they got to check the scene and everything.
Apparently, it doesn't work as well as they intended. I thought that it worked pretty well the first time I saw it because the actor sells it. He plays it like, oh shit, I forgot something. You wait here. He doesn't say that, but it's in the performance. You wait here. I'm going to go and check on something inside. But yeah, on watching this movie multiple times, I can't figure out why he's actually going back in there.
No.
But he finds that Peter Neal is still alive. And then this shot happens. The only reason I want to point out this shot is because Brian De Palma ripped the shot off like wholesale in Raising Kane. But he, I think because it was invented in Tenebrae, the shot where somebody is revealed standing behind another person when they duck out of the out of the frame.
That's our advice to you. Find shots and stuff that you like that the modern, like the mass American audience probably hasn't seen and steal from them. Right. That's why you look like a genius.
Well, it's De Palma also had a history of cribbing from Alfred Hitchcock.
Sure.
And, like direct, you know, lifts and stuff like that. But
hey, if you're gonna.
I know Argento said something to the effect of like, you know, De Palma is an important filmmaker. And if he borrows from me, like, you know, that's okay. All right. So really quickly before, I don't know if it means anything that, Peter Neal is killed by art.
Oh, he really literally is. He's killed by art,
by a sculpture, which we've been staring at for like the past 15 minutes of the movie.
Right. Was, and, that looks sharp.
Oh, that was something else I wanted to point out, is that in a lot of
the five endings,
these giallo endings, all of the settings are absolutely incredible. And there's always like weird things going on in them. And it's cool that they use those settings for some purpose.
You're saying like the locations or the sets or?
Yeah, the sets. You know, it's like there's weird artwork. The walls look weird. There's
even in Deep pictures. Red, those pictures, they're all like vacant-eyed people, zombie-looking. It's very weird.
They use something in, you know, like the artwork at the end of Tenebrae to kill him and the mirror and in the bathroom of, I'm getting them all confused Deep Red, the mirrored wall, you know, it's like they use the weirdness of the sets for some purpose.
Well, you know, when you're talking about locations, it's like the thing that strikes me about Tenebrae, which also separates it from the rest of the giallo films, is the fact that, like, it's shot in Rome, but it goes out of its way, I think, to not look like Rome. Like, I mean,
not specifically,
usually go after the landmarks.
Right. Coliseum, you know? And whatnot.
Yeah, because all the other ones do. At some point, they work in some kind of old architecture, but Deep Red goes for all this like hyper modern stuff. The lesbian's house is super modern,
Nighthawks and whatnot.
In
Deep Red.
In Deep Red, yeah. Where he constructs the set of, the Edward Hopper painting.
Yeah.
Like, just builds it, you know? But, usually, I think, Don't Torture a Duckling, the Lucio Fulci one. That one takes place, in the Italian countryside, which to me, Red is really odd because most of them take place in an urban, very chic,
right,
very fashion forward, right, Italian.
Clean lines and edges. Yeah. And
yeah. But you still see the Italian architecture right there. I think the other one too is, the Red Queen Kills Seven Times took place in a castle, which was we're in a castle.
We're never going to get this quiz right.
We should do the quiz, right?
Yeah, all right, I think so.
Here we go. This is Arian versus Sean for dominance in the first ever Giallo movie title.
Probably quiz. First and last, I'm going to say.
Is it real or is it fake?
Is it real or is it Giallo?
The iguana with the tongue of fire. Arian.
Not a Giallo.
Sean.
Not a Giallo.
You're both wrong. Oh, that's from 1971.
We're screwed.
That sounds like a B drive-in movie theater title.
That's an actual movie. Oh. Okay, there's 15 of these. Next one. The House with the Yellow Carpet, Arian.
No.
No.
That is an actual movie from 1983. My Heart is an Assassin with One Red Eye, Arian.
No.
I'm going to say no because they're claiming it's like My Heart, doesn't seem like Giallo.
All right, you both get a point because that is fake. All right, next one. What are those strange drops of blood doing on Jennifer's body?
No.
I'm going to say no to that one.
You're both wrong.
What?
It's a real movie. Lord. It's also known as The Case of the Bloody Iris.
Oh, you can't. I know that one.
That's the original Italian title. All right. How about A Glass Eye on a Blue Satin Pillow?
Yes.
Yes.
That is fake. No damn for you guys. Next one. Strip Nude for Your Killer.
No.
Yes.
It is a movie from 1975. Sean has 1 point. The House with the Laughing Windows.
Yes.
No.
Arian gets a point. That is a movie from 1976. A Blind Lizard in an Empty Grave.
Yes.
No.
It's fake. Sean gets a point there. Kill the Fatted Calf and Roast It.
No.
I'm going to say yes.
It is a real movie from 1970.
Got two.
A Blood-Stained Orchid on a Silver Casket.
Yes.
Yes.
No. That's a fake movie.
Damn it.
Five Dolls for an August Moon.
Yes.
No.
It is a movie. So Arian gets a point. 1970. A Lizard in a Woman's Skin.
Yes.
No.
It is a movie. Damn it. That's Lucio Fulci,
1971. They like lizards, don't they?
I guess. The Black Cat with the Blood-Stained Lips.
Yes.
No.
It is not a movie. Two more. Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key.
No.
It seems overly long, but I'll say yes.
It is a movie from 1972. And The Perfume of the Lady in Black.
Yes.
No.
It is a movie. Tied. All right, so that's it. So you're tied?
Okay, the last one did not have any of these Giallo thingamajiggies.
Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key. I've always wanted to see that movie. Because that's got to be one of the greatest titles of all time.
But there's no
animals, you can literally just...
No color,
that's true.
Here, pick six words and put them in, and then that's your title for Giallo. That's it.
Basically. Well, that's what you got to go to. I think it's giallogenerator.com or something. You just keep hitting that thing. It gives you plots. It gives you made-up directors and all this stuff. It's fantastic. All right, so now it's time to summon Igor. Igor, where art thou, sir?
Masters, the mail. I've got the mail. So many letters. Our followers are rising.
And thank you for the mail, Igor.
You look taller, Igor. You're wearing lips in your shoes? Like, what's going on?
First up, we have from Chris Huddleston writes in about our In the Mouth of Madness episode. Mm. He says, I have similar feelings to you guys on this one. I saw it when it originally came out and was pretty disappointed. It seemed like mediocre Carpenter. Then I watched it again a couple of years ago and really enjoyed it. It's not up there with Carpenter's best, but it's certainly better than a vast majority of 90s horror and overlooked, underappreciated flick. All right. Thank you for writing in, Chris. About Critters.
What?
Okay, so this came out of the blue, but I did post a photograph of when we did Critters on our Facebook page, which is where everybody's writing.
The first
in.
By one, the way, Critters? That's
Facebook.com/Saturday Night Freak Show. I'm not actually sure. I posted a picture of the two alien bounty hunters and a fellow named Rob McLeod. Oh, there can be only one.
McLeod, there can be only one.
He just wrote, man, those guys are ugly. So we told you, if you write in, we'll read it. And
get it? Do you get it? Do you get it? Ugly?
Ug and Lee.
Ah, there it is. It's funny.
Because the bounty hunters are named.
See, it's ugly. Funny because they're Ug and Lee. Right, they're ugly.
Yeah.
I appreciate your humor, sir. If nobody else here does, I like it. Thank you for writing in.
It's time for wrap-ups. And so that means we start with Arian. The floor is yours.
Well, Tenebrae, I wouldn't say is his best, but I did enjoy it. Even though I kind of netted off a little bit there for about 5 minutes. The plot wasn't as well put together as it could have been, but overall, I'd say it's worth a look-see. That's me. I'm done.
All right. So it sounded like a recommendation.
Yeah.
Tenebrae. I think it's I think it's it feels to me like the most straightforward of the Dario Argento movies that I've seen. And I think I appreciate it because of that. I like the story of this movie. I really like the visuals of his movies. I think I appreciate those more in his other movies than the storyline, but I think it all comes together in this movie. This is the second time I've seen it. I think it was much clearer this time. I think the last time I watched it was after we made a short film.
Oh,
kind
shit.
Of in the genre of this movie called Slit.
Which you can find on Amazon Instant Video and other fine places online.
Please do watch that.
Love the gel genre so much.
There it is. I think we watched it right after finishing that one up. And it made more sense like watching it through this time. And it's pretty clear movie. I liked it because of that. So I definitely recommend it. This is, yeah, as far as Argento goes, I like this one a lot.
Well, yeah, it's been one of those movies, like, you know, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Argento, and it's weird, you know, it's like, I've always been a fan of John Carpenter, and the more that time goes on, it's like, the more I become more and more interested in Argento's stuff and just his style. It's like, and he was around beforehand, and, you know, I think, like, obviously Carpenter saw Deep Red.
Obviously. Like, before he made Halloween. I've watched Deep Red for the first time tonight. He had to have seen this movie. Like, this, it was definitely an influence on his later work. This came out before Halloween. Like, Deep Red definitely influenced Carpenter and Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And so I guess, but I've always attributed to Argento, like, his best films to me have always been, like, Suspiria, Deep Red, Tenebrae, and Opera. Now, three of those are straight up giallo movies. I don't really count Suspiria. I know a lot of people do, but it doesn't. That doesn't feel like a giallo to me. That feels
it doesn't
like
end like a giallo. Let's put it that way.
Yeah,
movie,
it's
right?
A supernatural.
But Tenebrae is like it's increasing in my estimation every time that I see it, and I think part of it is because what Sean said. I think it is one of the most accessible of his movies, which is kind of surprising. You know, like because you know. For a filmmaker and a genre not entirely known for their
coherent storytelling.
Yeah. This one is remarkably, I think, easy to follow, even though it is completely misleading you, you know, I was going to say a primrose path. That makes no sense, but okay. So I think, you know, the style of it, it's ironic, I think, because the movie is brightly lit and very sharp, right? Mm. Which is actually in stark contrast to the title. Tenebrae is Latin for shadow, but apparently it is also it's a ceremony conducted at the end of the Latin mass where the candles are extinguished.
Yeah.
That's the, yeah. So I guess I'm going into.
That actually makes a lot of sense.
Candles are extinguished.
Yeah.
Lives are extinguished.
So I've wondered, like, does that apply? You can read the title as like it's ironic because it's a title called Shadow, but the whole movie takes place in bright.
In every light.
Yeah. Or because the lead main character has a shadow personality or something. I don't know. But yeah, I think as time goes on, I almost like this maybe more than Deep Red. I mean, Deep Red's like the Citizen Kane of Giallo where you're like, okay, this is the one that kind of set it in stone, but this one's like a better version of it, where this is the one that I think, I think you could show to a neophyte to Giallo movies and say, like, here you go. They're not all like this, but, you know, this is a pretty good one. So I would definitely recommend Tenebrae. To everyone. And next week, we're going to be watching a movie that's going to be chosen by Travis.
Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
Where the fuck did you come from? Have you been standing in the corner the whole time?
You opened the box, I came.
Boom. So that's next week on the Saturday Night Freak Show. And until then, we're going to stop paying the electric bill, and the basement is going dark.